Welcome to the ADHD Women's Wellbeing Podcast. I'm Kate Moore Youssef, and I'm a wellbeing and lifestyle coach, EFT practitioner, mum to four kids, and passionate about helping more women to understand and accept their amazing ADHD brains. After speaking to many women just like me, and probably you, I know there is a need for more health and lifestyle support for women newly diagnosed with ADHD. In these conversations, you'll learn from insightful guests, hear new findings, and discover powerful perspectives and lifestyle tools to enable you to live your most fulfilled, calm, and purposeful life wherever you are on your ADHD journey. Here's today's episode. Today, I'm delighted to welcome two fantastic psychotherapists. Their names are Katie McKenna and Helen Villiers, and they co-host the successful, fantastic Insight podcast, where I've learned so much about narcissism and parentification. Now, they have just written a brilliant new book called You're Not the Problem, The Impact of Narcissism and Emotional Abuse and How to Heal. I'm delighted to have them here because we're really going to delve into a fascinating conversation about understanding perhaps our childhood, understanding the way we've been parented, and being able to sort of decipher where some of our trauma has come from. Katie and Helen, I am so excited to have this conversation with you. It's been a long time coming, and I know that the listeners of this podcast will be fascinated because these conversations come up a lot. You know, we're going to be talking about parentification, narcissism, emotional unavailability, family, you know, dysfunction, trauma. It's a conversation that happens with all my clients, and there's a common thread that so many people who are being diagnosed with ADHD later on in life are also navigating childhood trauma. And, you know, this is going to be a nuanced conversation. You are both highly experienced psychotherapists, so I feel we're in very, very good hands here. So first of all, welcome to the podcast.
Thank
I'm delighted
you.
To have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I thought maybe we can get some of the lingo out the way so we can sort of just bed in, because some people haven't gone through therapy and they don't understand these words that I hear on your podcast, I hear on your fantastic social media channels. So can we begin with maybe just breaking down what you see narcissism, or how you would describe narcissism? Because for me, I always thought it was incredibly extreme. Like if you were almost like a psychopath. And actually, that's not true, is it?
Okay, so narcissistic personality disorder, there's a number of traits that we look for when diagnosing. Katie and I are not qualified to diagnose anyone, and we would never attempt to do that anyway, whether it's sort of armchair diagnosis or whatever. But narcissistic personality disorder, when we look at overt and covert, there are five traits that cross both presentations. The five main traits are grandiosity, entitlement, exploitation, motivational empathy, which is one that people get wrong a lot because they'll say there's a complete lack of empathy, and it's not that. There's motivational empathy, and then impaired self-awareness. So we have those five main traits, and what people do often is exactly what you do and think that somebody who is MPD is like a psychopath, like the Ted Bundy type person who was someone who was diagnosed with MPD. So the problem with that is that only the extreme cases get brought to general population attention because they're so extreme, and they come with them these awful, awful behaviours such as murdering and killing. However, it is absolutely a spectrum, just as it is with any other kind of ADHD, autism, neurodivergence. MPD is a huge spectrum, and someone could be diagnosable but mild, and diagnosable and the Ted Bundy extreme, and then everything else in between. So it's a really important understanding to have that, also prevalence being a big thing, that people go, oh my God, it's really rare. It's not that rare. The prevalence is thought to be about 0.5 to 1.6% of the general population, which sounds low, but is actually extremely high when you start thinking about it. And then on top of that, that statistic is thought to be flawed simply because people who have MPD are not going to put themselves in way of assessment. They are only assessed when it's ordered by a court or some kind of psychiatric breakdown. So basically, they will do everything, including avoiding sort of street surveys that might show whether or not they've got narcissistic traits because, and here's the thing, they are aware. They know that they are different. So, yeah, that's NPD in a fairly large nutshell, sorry.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating because you're saying they are aware, but then we kind of think they're not aware. And so do they choose where they bring that awareness? And would they outwardly, I don't know, do they outwardly want to heal? Or is it just a no-no, like they're just happy with who they are?
Well, it's everybody else's problem and not theirs. If you've got a problem with it, especially somebody who is more covert presenting, will be dismissive of any concerns about, I think you've got NPD. Well, so what? It's got me to where I am now. If you've got a problem with my behaviour, that's your problem, not mine. And someone who is more covert presenting will be like, how could you say that about me? But never look at why someone might say that. So no, there's not a willingness to accept that there's anything wrong with their behaviour, but they do know that they use those behaviours. Because don't forget, they know how to hide it and they know how to only use it on people who they can use it on. So
the manipulation side. Mm. Yeah. Okay. So there's that. And then I wanted to talk about parentification as well. Well, maybe you can explain what parentification is and then we can start sort of like bringing in lots of the many notes that I've got written down.
Okay, well, there's three different types of parentification, and there's emotional and instrumental. We'll start with them. And emotional parentification is where the parent treats the child as their confidant, as their mini therapist, as their best friend. And that's often what we hear the child say, you know, me and my mother or me and my father, we were so close. We were two peas in a pod. They told me everything. I was the go-between within the relationship. And that is the parent leaning on the child emotionally. It's really damaging. It's really destructive to the child. And a lot of the times the child will think that they are complicit and have given consent to that because they've asked the parent, you know, mommy, why are you crying? Or daddy, you know, why are you not speaking to mom? And this is where the parent is supposed to hold boundaries and say, you know, this is between me and your mother and not involve the child. Whereas the child will actually think that they are consenting to this and they can't. This is where the parent should hold boundaries and not lean emotionally on the child. Instrumental parentification is when, I think Helen calls it Cinderella syndrome.
Yeah.
And if you just imagine that, Cinderella going around cooking, cleaning, raising their other siblings, you know, doing chores that are not age appropriate, because it's very important that your child, you know, tidies up after themselves. But this will be where the child is responsible for paying bills, for putting their children to bed, cooking dinners, getting their children out to school, essentially being a mini mother.
The important thing being about them not being able to say no, isn't it? If they were to say, I don't want to babysit my sibling, they get horrifically punished, don't they?
Yeah, it's the absolute conditioning of the child that this is how they show love, is to be of servitude to their parents. And if they ever say no, they're called selfish, self-centered, you know, greedy, mean, a bad child, essentially. And ultimately, all the child wants to do is protect that attachment relationship that they have with their parent. So they'll do anything that is expected to avoid that emotional abandonment. And then we have the third, which is narcissistic parentification, which is both instrumental and emotional parentification combined. But it's that plus the parent is projecting a full image, a full personality onto the child. So the child in no way will get to be able to express themselves, have their own autonomy, have their own likes or dislikes. Anything that goes against what the parent deems appropriate will be seen as a rejection from the parent.
Okay. Wow. Mm-hmm. So
that's a lot there, is it?
I know, so much information.
And you can see how, you know, this conversation will be so nuanced because you might be able to pluck out different ways that you've been parented or your childhood that you can see. And everyone has such unique experiences and such a unique childhood. And then when we've got this new understanding of our own neurodivergence, and perhaps we can see certain qualities of this in our parents, and perhaps we can see undiagnosed neurodivergence in our parents. And it's really hard to be able to say, okay, well, what was the ADHD? What was the autism? And where was this, you know, this parent that didn't know better? And where do we stop gaslighting ourselves and start having a validation of that was right, that was not right, and we should have been parented better? And where can we bring maybe some compassion and forgiveness. And I find this really hard to know where that is and where we can. Obviously, we all, you know, as adults, we want to heal. And if there has been generational trauma, if there has been childhood trauma, how do we begin that process of healing, but also, you know, saying that wasn't right and we deserved better?
It's a very, very simple black and white thing for me. It doesn't matter if it was autism. It doesn't matter if it was ADHD. It doesn't matter if it was MPD. If it hurt you, it hurt you. And that's the end of it. The only place at which we start offering compassion is where the parent accepts responsibility for how they might have hurt us. And then we can say, thank you for the apology. If they give the apology, that is, if they accept responsibility, if they apologize and ask how they can atone for it, then we can maybe start moving towards compassion and forgiveness. But when it's MPD, there is not going to be that. That won't happen. So if we're talking about someone who is MPD and ADHD and autistic or either, that doesn't matter. The ADHD and autism don't matter in there. What you're talking about, I think, is having compassion for our own selves as neurodivergent ADHD autistic people who might make mistakes as parents or people that do look similar to the MPD parent. And actually, the difference is, of course, that you accept responsibility. You look at how you can heal however you hurt somebody and change your behavior so that you manage your impact on others in a positive way, not to the point where you are hiding or shaming or silencing yourself. But I think it's, and maybe this is my ADHD, it's really black and white. The other thing I just want to point out, which is something that's quite controversial and people in the ND community find quite difficult, is that MPD counts as a neurodivergence because neurodivergence is any brain type that is different to neurotypical. And so we have to be really careful with our terminology that when we're talking about neurodivergence, we are actually including MPD in that. Anyway, CPTSD, we're talking about schizophrenia, we're talking about loads of different brain types that operate differently to neurotypical brains. So just wanted to kind of pop that in as well. But I think what is really important is it doesn't matter why someone hurt you. It matters that they hurt you. It doesn't matter why we justify the reason behind that. It's that they hurt you. So when we start looking for reasons or understanding as to why they hurt us, that just gaslights us more and doesn't allow us to own what happened to us as seriously as it did. So yeah, for me, it's very simple. It doesn't matter whether it was ADHD, autism, MPD, or anything else, it hurt you and therefore it hurt. And someone has to take responsibility for that. Then we start looking at the nuance of MPD, ADHD, autism, which for me, actually, there isn't a nuance. It's very black and white, or very clear, sorry. But we look at where people take responsibility for their behaviour and acknowledge the impact that they've had.
It's really interesting that you say that. It's acknowledging the impact. It's taking responsibility. And when there's a victim sort of like mentality of, well, I had it really hard, or things were really difficult, and you don't know what I went through when I was parenting you. And they sort of put that back on you, that we should have understood as a child, like we should have been more, we should have just been able to just accept that that's just the way it was. At what point does a child, you know, who's older now, can we ever get past that older parent's victim-like mentality where they won't claim responsibility or they still believe that their resources were limited and that's the way they, you know, they could parent you? How would you suggest someone who is on that, you know, they're doing the work, they're becoming more self-aware themselves, they're reading the books, they're listening to podcasts like yours and like this, but this part of them just can't heal because they haven't had that validation from the parent?
So I suppose you mentioned it there. One of the things that me and Helen really try to do, the whole purpose of our podcast and actually in the book, is educating people, the psychoeducation part on what is abuse. And what I'm hearing you talk about there is motivational empathy. When somebody is sitting in their victim space, so in this instance, imagine it's the mother sitting in their victim space when their child is coming to them saying, you know, when you do X, Y, or Z, it hurts me. And the mother is gaslighting them, right? Denying, minimizing, dismissing their experience, but is also trying to elicit the child's empathy, trying to make them feel guilty because you don't know how bad I've had it. It's been so hard for me. And the mother is centering themselves, right? Making it all about themselves. but is trying to elicit that empathy from the child to make the child feel sorry for the mother. So they'll end up, you know, apologizing or saying, oh my God, you know, and it has been so bad for you. So again, this is where the parent is emotionally parentifying the child, putting their burdens on the child. And ultimately, it's to avoid that accountability and responsibility. It's instead of them turning around and saying, you're right, I did that, and that was wrong. How can I do it different next time? What do you need from me? How can I make amends? Right? Obviously, this hurt you, and I'm sorry, and I want to do better. How can I make it up to you? This is the parent wants to absolutely avoid that because they want to avoid changing their behavior at all costs, and they want to manipulate the child. And this is where it's really hard for people to actually see that, to remove that denial, that this is intentional to avoid that accountability and responsibility, to manipulate the child, to make the child feel sorry for the parent, to put that weight of emotional responsibility on the child. And that's what's damaging. And when we educate our clients, and ultimately then through the podcast and with the book, which is called You're Not the Problem, and when people are able to be empowered then to recognize this, to not fall for it, to not fall for the manipulation, and to recognize what they're doing, which is putting up barriers and deflecting, and again, avoiding that responsibility.
Would you mind explaining, just breaking down motivational empathy so people can really understand what that looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. Motivational empathy is where your empathy is weaponized against you. So it's using fear, obligation, and guilt to make you behave in a way that is against your desire, your want, your need, but to meet the should. So I should do this thing, or I should go home for Christmas, otherwise my mother gets upset and I just don't want to make her feel bad and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So motivational empathy is making you feel bad for holding a boundary, for calling out a behavior, for holding accountability, for desiring to meet your need over theirs. And it's using your empathy to silence you, essentially.
Can we give even a wee example of that? So for example, financially, if I was to use motivational empathy on you, Kate or Helen, I might say, oh, I have no money to pay my bills on Saturday. I have a big electricity bill and I have no money. Right? I'm gonna pause, giving you space, hopefully that you will rescue me. So I'm wondering for your listeners or even you, Kate, sitting in that space, or if I said, oh, I have no babysitter on Saturday night and I have a friend and it's a really important party. I really want to go to it, but I'm not able to go because I've no one to mind the kids.
And then the answer to that is, what are you going to do about that? Rather than jumping in to rescue.
So there I'm trying to elicit your empathy to rescue. So I'm avoiding being an adult and asking you directly, one, can you loan me money? Or two, can you mind the children? So I'm sitting in that victim space. But the other place that it can be used as well, if you're holding me accountable for something. So if Helen says, Katie, when you did that thing last week, I didn't like it. Or when a child says it to their parent, I don't like when you call me names. I don't like when you belittle me. Oh my God, I can't do anything right. I'm just the worst parent in the world. It's just terrible. Right. And again, what they want is to force the child into a place of rescue. And mom, I didn't mean that. That's not what I was saying. And then we're deflecting and we're off point completely.
I would love to just add really quickly to your original question that our healing doesn't lie in an apology from somebody. Our healing lies in our own validation of ourselves, our experience, our own pain. And we do not need our abuser to acknowledge that they abused us in order for us to heal. And we do not need to forgive our abuser in order for us to heal. And if we can make sure we get that really clear in our minds and really embedded in our process, we've got a much higher chance of actually healing rather than waiting for someone who has absolutely no intention whatsoever of saying, yes, I was abusive to you. Rather than waiting for them to do that, we can say it for ourselves. It is enough that we know it happened to us. We do not need our abuser to validate it for us.
I think that's really powerful because sometimes most of the time we probably won't get that acknowledgement or the apology. What would you say to someone who is still got that person in their life and we still see them a lot and they're sort of just part of the family and the resentment's still there and the low-lying sort of anger that you just can't be in the same room with them, or when you are in the same room, you sort of bristle, your body just kind of tenses up. And there isn't much we can do about, I say you live in Australia and you see that parent once a year and you can sort of just kind of go about your day and that's it. But if that person is part of your life a grandparent, and you know they have a good relationship with your children, what do you do then when you're not getting that validation, but you still want to heal?
Wow. There's so many parts to that. And if I can break it down, I think into three, and then I'll bring Helen in to add in it. One, what I'm hearing is healthy anger, right? So anger at the way you've been treated. And that's valid. For anybody that grows up, especially with a narcissistic parent, one of the emotions that's going to be so suppressed is anger, that healthy anger, because you will be punished. You will be stonewalled, given the silent treatment. They will be aggressive or passive aggressive towards you when you're speaking up. So a lot of the times that fight can be annihilated. And a lot of the times the child just fawns and acquiesces to the parent, again, to keep that safety. What I'm hearing then different is what you're talking about, resentment towards the person. Resentment is actually for ourselves to show us where we've betrayed ourselves. So if I become resentful for giving you something, let's say, Kate, if I have to give you something again and again and I become resentful, it's so easy to think that that's about you because you're taking it. Whereas actually the resentment is to show up to me, where have I betrayed myself? Where should I have used my no? And where did I not? And chances are it's out of fear, obligation, and guilt. And this then leads us on to what you're talking about. Well, what if you have no choice? And that can just feel so disempowering and so helpless when we say that we don't have a choice in something. And I hear you saying, God, imagine if a parent lived in Australia and then they never have to face that difficult decision in saying no or not attending something. Because recognizing that we have a choice in the situation, when we say we don't have a choice, it's really saying that I don't want to accept the consequences of making this difficult choice. If I say no, for example, of going to a function, what is the consequences going to be for me in that? How am I going to be punished? And I might want to avoid that, and that's valid. So therefore, I will acquiesce and then go to the function. But even in that, if I go to the function, I still have choice around that. How long do I stay? How do I engage? How do I, for example, grey rock and not give all these people information about me? So how do I hold my boundaries then in that space? But in that, it's acknowledging that I do have a choice not to go, but it's recognizing the punishment that will be received in that. And even as I'm saying that, if you're going to be punished for saying no, well, then you're in an abusive relationship. You're being silenced in that moment, that you don't get to have autonomy and get a choice to say, I don't want to attend the thing. And again, it's recognizing and fully acknowledging how somebody responds to your no.
Yeah, yeah. When we are talking about all of this, and you know, let's look through that lens of neurodivergence as well. We hear a lot of dysfunction, chaos, addiction. And lots of things that we look back on and we see, a huge amount of, first of all, lack of awareness, self-awareness, but also general awareness where we may just, all this sort of psychological term, all these terminologies and what we know now from social media, from even your amazing social media post, from your podcast, now your book, that awareness wasn't there even 10, 15 years ago. So we're sort of this new generation of, understanding and learning about these terminologies and really picking them. And when we put it to the older generation, say, and saying things like parentification, toxicity, narcissism, gaslighting, emotional unavailability, it's almost like speaking a different language, isn't it? So do you think that in a way, it's really good for us, this generation, who are really understanding themselves psychologically and understanding and able to process certain childhoods. But in a way, it is difficult because we're working with an older generation who aren't understanding, don't want it. Therapy still to them is like, oh, what do I need to go to therapy for? Why would I want to unpick my childhood? That's just pain and trauma that I don't need to go with. And so we're in this kind of sticky situation of fantastic, we've got all this awareness, but then still, how can we can't have those difficult conversations, or it feels hard to have those difficult conversations. And even the word boundaries, when we talk about boundaries, it's like, what do you mean talking about boundaries all the time? And it's almost like we need one more generation so we can understand things better together. Does that make sense, that question?
Yeah, but I think what we have to be really careful of is ignorance and weaponized ignorance, because It's one thing to not understand that when it was normal in the 80s to, like, I don't know, leave your children feral all day and then just, like, feed them occasionally, whatever. Like, it's one thing to kind of have done what was the norm for the era. And it's another thing to have done what was norm for the era and then completely deny that it had any negative impact on the child that grew up in it. Because even I now, as I know, I'm a psychotherapist and I've got all these qualifications and experience and understanding, can look back at parenting my 15-year-old and think about how I parented him as a small child and that I would do things differently. And I can accept responsibility and know that there are things that maybe I did that have had a negative impact on him, even though I was operating out of what was either normal or the best of intentions. I can still accept that even though I had all those good intentions, it maybe wasn't helpful for him and it's had a negative impact. So we have to look at, there's ignorance and weaponized ignorance. When someone's just like, well, it's all changed and I don't understand it. Well, that's not true, is it? Because it was the same for the generation before them. Their previous generation. I always talk about this subject with likening it to rock and roll, right? So in the 50s, rock and roll became really trendy, didn't it? But it was seen as a sinful thing and it had this very negative thing, and there was, but the teenagers of the time were like, oh my God, Elvis Presley, he's amazing, and you know, and there was all this uproar about this and that, and then the Beatles came along and those generations were like, you don't understand, to the parents, and they will tell you, well, you don't understand what it was like growing up in my era, we had rock and roll and it was like this, that and the other. But they do understand progression of society. They do understand progression of understanding. And yes, they may sit in the, I don't want to look back at my trauma and unpick all of that. But again, that doesn't mean they get to deny how they've impacted their children, even if it was normal. And the other thing I want to say about that is, we did know quite a lot about attachment at this point. We did, you know, in the 80s, 70s, 60s, it wasn't as widely spoken about, but there were parenting books around that talked about it. And there were schools of thought and psychology was a thing. And like, this is not new understanding that we traumatize children by doing these things to them. It's a wider understanding thanks to social media and it kind of being shoved down people's throats and they don't really get a choice from it. By people like me and Katie. But the idea that they had absolutely no awareness of how they impacted their child on a wider scale is somewhat true, but also could be argued false. But on a micro scale, if a child stands in front of you and says, I don't like it when you do this thing to me, and you go, oh, stop whinging, you little brat, you know you are being harmful. You know you are putting your needs before the child's, you are silencing the child, you are making them feel bad. Because the other thing is, so often, what they said to their children, they would never say to another adult. And yet it was acceptable to say it to children, right? So the idea that they don't know what they're doing is so easily disproven. It's also in studies, Miller, Campbell and Pilkonis, 2007, prove that there is an awareness and an intent to harm, right? MPD is differentiated from other cluster B personality disorders by the very fact that they have an intent to harm significant others. So look at when we start using language that's sanitized, we start removing accountability and responsibility. We start silencing, as Katie said, and gaslighting the victims of that abuse by using this sanitized version. It's the same as we used to call PTSD shell shock, but we moved further and further away from the idea that PTSD happens because you've experienced this terrible, shocking trauma, right? So, yeah, the idea that we call it something like emotionally immature and therefore infantilize them, mm-hmm. removing responsibility from yes. them, right? It gaslights and silences the victims. Here's this parent that you just have to learn how to cope with and accept because that's the way they are and there's nothing you can do about it. And if you can't accept it, it means you're emotionally immature and therefore you are the problem. You're not. Yeah. You are not the problem. The problem is that these people grew up in systemic trauma, which is dates back. I mean, I could go on and on about why it's here and everything else, and I'm not going to, but They grew up in systemic trauma that was normalized to their generation and have then therefore passed it on. That is terrible. And it's not their fault that they grew up in that. And we can have compassion for that trauma, but it is their responsibility. And it doesn't mean we have to tolerate the behavior. And those are really, really important things to accept and absorb in terms of our healing, in terms of facing the reality, and exposing the denial, turning that light on, seeing how traumatized we actually are, and stop gaslighting ourselves and other victims, because it doesn't matter that they experience trauma and it doesn't matter that they're emotionally immature. What matters is they hurt you, and that's it.
Yeah. And that was, you've just answered my question, because I wanted to know, is it nature or nurture?
Oh.
And
well, that, look, I could go in for like years about this, because like obviously this was part of the masters, but nature, nurture, largely it's thought to be nurture. There is a lot of evidence that shows there's two schools of thoughts, lots of evidence that shows it's a severe attachment disorder growing up in trauma. There's potentially a genetic element, but that hasn't actually been established yet. It's just being explored. And yeah, so largely though, it's trauma where a child experiences extreme physical, sexual, emotional abuse, neglect, or, and this is really important, smothering, because that's why the golden child becomes the narcissist. You know, so yeah, it's generally thought to be trauma, but of course we have to leave room for the idea that there's a genetic element to it too.
Yeah, exactly what you said, you know, and sadly there's trauma, but it's taking that responsibility to do the work on themselves and to heal and to have that self-awareness to not pass it on to the next generation.
Right, exactly, yeah. Which is what you're doing, right? Because you're exploring yourself and you're increasing your self-awareness. You're trying to take responsibility. That's what Katie and I have done, is gone to therapy, done all this work continually. We hold each other accountable all the time, and we challenge and conflict, but in a very healthy way, not shouting and screaming. And that's because we want to be better people in better relationships, better parents, and responsible for our behavior, and not pass our trauma onto our children, justifying it in, well, it happened to me, so you can have it too, you know?
Yeah.
We often hear from people growing up in these environments, you know, they say, oh, I hate conflict. I have a fear of saying no, I'm just a people pleaser. They often even describe themselves as an empath, you know, I can attune to the needs of another, whereas there's no such thing as an empath. And what I hear when somebody says that is that they've been a victim of abuse, that they've learned to be hypervigilant, that they're able to predict the moods and behaviors of their parent by the turn of a head or by the way they're breathing. And that's hypervigilance. It's not being an empath. And the thing about having a fear of saying no, a child is born with their no. Before they're even able to verbalize and say no, firstly, it's one of the first words actually verbally. But even before that, they shake their head. They absolutely refuse. You know, they lie on the floor if they don't want to do something. They're conveying that no. And this abuse is so insidious. I remember sharing on the podcast from a client, it was only when she witnessed her mother feeding her child. So the mother's feeding the grandchild and the child's only about 1.5. And near the end of the food, the child is closing their mouth and shaking their head. And the grandmother is going, look at the wee bully. Look at the wee bully, what they're doing. And it was only that the mother sitting watching going, oh my God, this is where you're overpowering the no. This is where you're projecting an identity onto the child, calling them a bully, saying they're defiant, when actually they're just saying I'm full. And that's how they're conveying it. But the child is witnessing that anger, that contempt from the caregiver in that stage. Now, thankfully, the mother was there and was able to take the bowl off the parent and go, no, they're just full, which for a narcissistic parent took that as rejection and was very upset and, oh, I can't do anything right, and made it all about them. So this is how these behaviors are seeped in. And so just to go back to what you were talking about, Kate, then talking about boundaries, that was the child expressing a boundary. And as we get into adulthood, I think there's a lot of people then that confuse preferences with boundaries. So for example, if I was to say to you, Kate, please don't shout at me, right? That's me making a request. That's me letting you know that I want to stay in a relationship with you and I'm asking you for something. But that's not a boundary. A boundary is saying, if you continue to speak to me like that, I'm leaving. Right? That's a boundary. That's not me trying to control you at all. And that's me letting you know what I will and won't accept or tolerate in the relationship.
And holding the boundary would be Katie leaving when you shouted again. Yes. So people do get really, this is such an important thing, especially in ADHD autism, around this thing of they're trying to control my behavior. We see that kind of...
You're giving me an ultimatum is what's
You're giving
often
me
said.
An ultimatum, yeah. And it's, no, I'm telling you how I want to interact with other human beings. So the example I often use for this one is direct communication. Growing up ADHD, being very confused by social cues. I'm quite high on the autistic. I'm not quite across the threshold, but I'm very close to it. And I find social communication really confusing. Quite often I'll ring Katie and go, like, they asked me in for a cup of tea. Was I actually meant to go in or was I meant to say no? I don't really understand. And she'll clarify and tell me what the rules are and stuff. But so it's hilarious. But the social cue things I find very difficult. And when people are doing the unsaid subtext communication, the indirect communication, both feels manipulative and it feels like someone's trying to trick me into embarrassing myself or saying something or agreeing to something. Anyway, the boundary is direct communication. That's not to say you have to only speak to me in this way. It's to say that if you continue to use indirect communication with me, I'm going to have to leave the relationship for my own safety because I don't feel safe with indirect communication. And whilst I know it's difficult sometimes, it's a really important skill that we all have. Like when my son will just go, oh, I'm hungry. And I'm like, so what are you asking for? It's like, well, can I have some food, please? Oh, there it is. You know, because ask for the need to be met. Don't imply what the need is and kind of use motivational empathy to get it met. Because that's the other thing with indirect communication. It relies on motivational empathy quite a lot of times.
I'm asking all these questions from a personal perspective, but also, you know, the clients that I have, there's not one client that comes in and says that their childhood has been rosy. There's always been something going on. And I'd like to talk about the infantilization children and how that grows, especially where there's like one sibling and there's always one sibling. And potentially we see this again with neurodivergence as well, that maybe there's been an overprotectiveness or a parent who doesn't believe in that child's potential, or there's been something going on. And maybe you can explain what you would see as infantilizing a child, especially now that the child is grown adult.
First of all, what I think you're describing is enmeshment. And I'm going to let Katie talk about that because that's her speciality as well.
I'm going to pull them apart into two separate things, the infantilization and the enmeshment. Mm-hmm. Because for the parentified child, we can actually hear them being described as an old head on young shoulders, being very mature for their age, being hyper-independent.
Yeah, that was me.
Okay, and they can be enmeshed with their parent because they're able to anticipate the parent's needs and wants, feel so sorry for them because obviously the parent then is trauma dumping on the child and treating them like a confidant and a counselor. So there can be an enmeshment in there. And I suppose what I'm hearing you talk then about infantilization, and typically we see, and I say typically because, you know, these can differ. It can be different for everybody. But typically who we would see infantilized is the golden child. And often that can be a boy in the family system, it can be the eldest or even the youngest. They can be really babied. And the infantilization is all about the gain for the parent. Again, because if the child isn't able to function in society as an adult, well, then there's a huge gain because you're always going to rely on me. You're always going to depend on me. And therefore, you're going to stay close. You're not going to go and have autonomy and succeed and fly off in the world. So there's a huge fear of abandonment there from the parent. And then they're exploiting the relationship to have the child dependent on them. They're also setting the child up for failure in future relationships because now the adult will look for a mother figure in a relationship as opposed to an equal romantic partner. And again, the mother is sitting in that superiority going, well, nobody will do for you what I will do for you. And do you hear then that kind of covert sexual abuse then in that message? That here, we have the most wonderful relationship in the world. You don't need to go to anybody else because they won't fulfill that for you. You know, nobody will love you like I do. And that's just a disgusting message and comment to give to a child, because what we want them to know is that there's safe people in the world. You will be loved. Go and have healthy relationships. And I will always be here if you ever need to come back. I will be that safety for you to fall back on. But be an adult, be autonomous.
Yeah. Yeah. It's with that enmeshment, there is a constant source of supply to the narcissistic parent. And so they don't ever want to surrender it. You know, we used to call it apron strings, didn't we? That kind of cutting the apron strings. And it's about being so tied to your parent that you're constantly giving the emotional feedback that they need from other people, especially NPD relies on other people to provide this emotional feedback, emotional sources, emotional supply. And so they look to other people to do that. But when you get a narcissistic parent has a child, holy moly, we've got built-in supply. So they use all their children for whatever emotional feedback they want. So we have a golden child, a scapegoat, an invisible child. But we're using those children to either give the adoration and the adulation or to be the placeholder for the hatred, self-hatred. So, yeah, that's what enmeshment is all about, that constant source of supply and being number one. See, I'm number one to the child. I want them to care about me more than anyone else in the world. So I'll keep them as close as possible and I will disempower them at every opportunity.
Sorry, what I was hearing you say then about witnessing that relationship, if that is a sibling then, Helen was absolutely right in saying that you can't force somebody to see the light. And in that, there's a huge grief because there's a letting go then of the person when they're still stuck in that enmeshment, when they're still in that toxicity. And that grief is valid and feeling it is really painful, but it's also a hugely healing emotion to feel that grief.
I think ultimately everything we've been talking about today is how can I avoid feeling the grief? And that is the thing that we have to feel, is that we have to face the grief. We have to face the pain. We have to face that if I want to be a healed human that has healthy relationships, I might have to let go of toxic relationships. And those toxic relationships might be ones that I've been conditioned to believe are really, really important to me. And I might have to accept that that person is never going to be who I need them to be. And they're never going to respect me as an individual, as an autonomous being. And they are always going to punish me every time I try and be myself. And therefore, I can't be around them. And with that is grief. And, you know, when we sit in that, like, is this ADHD? Is it autism? Is it NPD? What we're talking about is toxic hope. Because if I can pin it on ADHD or autism and therefore make it acceptable, then hopefully I can still have a relationship with them. But that toxic hope kills us. It literally destroys us. It is denial. It is denial of grief. And we have to sit in the grief and feel it. And sometimes that means that we lose those relationships. It's painful. It's really, really, really painful. But on the other side of that is freedom, liberation, and healthy relationships in a way that you can't actually imagine in existing until you've done that grieving. You know, it's amazing to be on this side of it, to be honest.
Yeah, thank you for that, because it's really beautifully explained. And, you know, the book that, you know, is going to be out very soon, or hopefully just out, is it talking about lots of these conversations that we've just had today? And are you able to give the readers takeaways or ways that they can help themselves if they can't go through your amazing therapy? I guess, what was the point of writing this book for you both?
Yeah, it's literally called You're Not the Problem, The Impact of Narcissism and Emotional Abuse and How to Heal, right? So we literally break down what narcissism is, how it impacted you, what emotional abuse is, how that impacts you, and how you can heal from it. And, you know, the point of the book for me was, we are very privileged to have as much knowledge as we do. You know, both of us have done a huge amount of work around this subject matter. And to be able to share that knowledge is a huge honor, first of all. But when we're doing one-to-one therapy, that's only one person. But when we're sitting on socials and using the podcast and then the book, we are empowering people to own what's happened to them, to take responsibility for their own behavior, their own coping mechanisms, and to heal and to demand healthier relationships in their life. So for me, it's about sharing knowledge that I have gained through my master's, through my work, and empowering other people to get to where we are today in terms of healthy relationships and healing. So, yeah, Katie.
It's breaking patterns, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
absolutely
breaking these generational patterns.
Yeah.
Katie, go for it.
Yeah, well, it's really seconding what Helen is saying there. For me, it's all about psychoeducation. And again, making this as readily available as possible. You know, therapy is a privilege even for people to attend. There's a lot of people for socioeconomic reasons can't afford it. So it's making this available, which is why we have the podcast and we have a support group, Inside Exposing Narcissism Facebook group. We also then have a Patreon if people want to explore these topics more in depth. But in terms of the book, yes, we go into these topics, break them down chapter by chapter. And again, it's about empowerment. We talked about one there, motivational empathy, but it's, let's even just look at entitlement for a second, because a lot of people will know this about their parent. They'll say, oh, they make everything about themselves. The whole world revolves around them. It's all about them. Helen has an analogy, you know, go and spot the narcissist at a party when it's an event that doesn't involve them. So like a christening, a birthday, a wedding, and they will make it all about themselves. And it's recognizing that there's actually a trait and it's called entitlement. And that's where this comes from. And we use examples and we use four characters throughout the book that's constant so that they can see what the impact of growing up with a parent like this. We break down parentification and boundaries and what boundaries are and what that looks like. And so, yeah, we're giving people really practical tools and exercises then in how to work through this and heal from this.
Yeah, it's not a cliffhanger or anything. It's not like, here's what's happened to you. Bye, go and sort it out. It's like, here's what's happened to you. Now, this is what you can do to fix it. And we've been told, and obviously we think it's a good read, but we've been told the feedback has been phenomenal, but also that it's very easy to read. And that was a really important thing for me as somebody with ADHD, that it was easy to read because, you know, we lose interest so quickly.
I think it sounds like the type of book so many people need, and to be able to demystify so much of this so they can really understand it. When you say about the practical side where you're sort of talking about, you know, I love the analogies that you use and really being able to bring it into sort of day-to-day examples. I think there's probably going to be quite a lot of healing in this book for many people, and also giving people choice and options, and like you say, autonomy, that they can make different decisions about their boundaries, about how they have relationships, how they parent and co-regulate with their children, and all these different things that we have, you know, if we're not, haven't got that self-awareness, we just mirror past behaviors. We just sort of carry on these patterns and we kind of think, well, I did okay. So, you know, I'm just going to carry on doing what my parents did. And, you know, hopefully my kids will be fine as well. So I just wanted to thank you for helping us interrupt these patterns. And, you know, when I first came across your, I think I came across you on social media first, and I remember watching the videos, I just like, oh my God, like, how do they know this? Like, how are they speaking this language? Like, I genuinely hadn't come across it before. And that's when I started listening to your podcast and just being blown away by your knowledge and how specific you were with certain situations. And that validation, you know, for me was incredibly emotional. And I've passed you, you know, on to quite a few clients as well.
Thank you.
I just want to thank you. Thank you so, so much for all that you do. And yeah, where can people find you? Are you taking on new clients, or are you directing people just towards groups and the book and the podcast?
I mean, I'm taking on new clients at the moment, but there'll be posts on my socials about that, I think. But in terms of the podcast, if they just go to www.insightpodcast.com, you will find everything. You'll find the book, the podcast, the Patreon, you'll find blogs, you'll find how to submit a letter to us, you'll find the Facebook group. So literally just go to that website. And yeah, Katie, are you taking on clients at the moment?
At the minute, I'm operating a waitlist. But again, if you go to that website, and you can find my website from there, and you can sign up to the waitlist, and I notify people whenever I'm taking on new clients. And again, offering them the autonomy to accept or decline. And because that's really what we're talking about here. That's the empowerment.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both so much for today, and hope to speak to you both very soon.
Thank you for having us. It's been lovely to talk to you. So thank you so much.
Thanks very much. It's been an amazing conversation. I've really enjoyed it.
I really hope you enjoyed this week's episode. If you did and it resonated with you, I would absolutely love it if you could share on your platforms, or maybe leave a review and a rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. And please do check out my website, adhdwomenswellbeing.co.uk, for lots of free resources and paid for workshops. I'm uploading new things all the time, and I would absolutely love to see you there. Take care, and see you for the next episode.